It's time for the big interview on today's edition of Money Life. Joining me now, Paul Seaton. He is Managing Director of Fulcrum Asset Management North America. If you want to learn what they're doing, and it's an interesting firm that is perhaps best known for its hedge funds, but is now doing funds that you can look at, it's fulcrumassetfunds.com. And they do global macro analysis, and that, you know, we love talking about because it's a great time to get big picture on a market that and an economy that is really going in no directions, but in a lot of interesting directions at the same time. Paul Seaton, thanks so much for joining me on Money Life.
Hey, Chuck. Thanks for having me.
So I do want to jump in with the global macro picture. We will get to the range bound markets that we've got, but you know, we in the United States have been so focused on getting through debt ceiling that that's been the one thing we've been looking at. But meanwhile, we've had a banking crisis that it's not gone. It just kind of got hidden behind other things. We've got an inflation problem that the rest of the world is dealing with. War in Ukraine is not going away anytime soon. When you look at this big picture, there are lots and lots of reasons why we should be expecting recession, not just here, globally. Yet it keeps not happening. Is it not going to happen at this point, or what's the outlook?
Chuck, I wish we had the crystal ball and knew exactly what was going to happen. But if we kind of think about this year and how it's evolved, coming into the year and the beginning of the year, we were very much in the inflation camp. We could see resilience in the economy, persistently high inflation. And then SVB happened, which kind of put the brakes on those views. And it wasn't clear whether this was going to be a broader market contagion. The authorities reacted very quickly, probably because they've learned from prior crisis that the longer you take, the more it costs ultimately. So reacted very quickly, flooding the market and getting confidence back. And then since that point, it's really been a case of let's see what's happening in the economy real time. Obviously, the debt ceiling negotiations have been something on the horizon as well. But just see how the economy responds and see, is the credit contraction severe enough to really slow the economy down and to do part of the job of the Fed and bring inflation down? Or is it really just an isolated incident? So this is where we find ourselves today, which we're trying to figure out as well. We probably on balance are more in the camp of the recession is a lower probability event, but it still might happen. We're more in the camp of the growth is resilient, inflation is more resilient than the market has probably appreciated. And we're seeing that in particular parts of the economy, which leads us back into the view that the Fed needs to do a little bit more to crack the economy if they want to bring inflation down. So we're not in the immaculate inflation coming down, soft landing camp. We certainly don't think that's achievable in the current state.
The Fulcrum Diversified Absolute Return Fund, which I should point out for the audience, it's ticker symbol FARIX. You are looking for high returns. Any absolute return fund is trying to make actual returns in any market condition with low volatility. How hard is that mission right now? Because we've got volatility, but we're range bound, and high returns, well, it's a very small segment of the market that seems to be generating whatever returns we're getting. So how does this market jive with your mission?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The leadership in the market is very narrow. So if you own the right, the top 10 names, you've probably got a nice return year to date. But underneath that, the gains aren't broad-based. We approach it in a number of different ways. And I think this is how we think about absolute return investing is we have three sub-strategies which operate in slightly different ways on slightly different investment horizons. So we have a dynamic asset allocation, which is looking on views 6 to 9 months. We're looking at our assessment of the economy, and this typically is long assets. This typically does well when the market goes up in a steady fashion, and it captures those returns. We then have what's called discretionary macro, which is faster trading, tracking the data, reacting to market events, market transitions. And that tends to do well in volatile environments where things are moving, things are chopping around a little bit. So it has a slightly shorter term horizon. And then the final part is what we call diversifying strategies, which is momentum. We're following trends in markets. This year, it's been a little bit harder for trend following, given what happened in March when a lot of the trend positions were reversed, but in a very short period of time. But some of those trends are starting to emerge again. We've seen trends in energies. We've seen trends in equities, which those have caught. So at any one point in time, not all strategies will be firing together, but there's a lot of latitude for different strategies to perform in different environments. So this year, the gains have really been carried by the dynamic asset allocation, where it's made sense to own risk assets. A lot of those assets which were hurt last year have really recovered this year. So different ways to skin a cat, but that's really why we have these three different sub-strategies in our portfolio.
I want to delve a little bit more into the third strategy, which is more technically based. Just before you appeared on this show, I was talking with someone who all about technicals, but they were looking at U.S. technicals as opposed to you're looking at technical signals globally. We talk on this show a lot about fundamentals and what have you around the world, but are the technicals in different markets dramatically different? I mean, are we at a spot where it's the U.S. that's range bound, but there are real opportunities elsewhere? Or if we're range bound, everybody's range bound?
Yeah, we kind of gone into a world where there's been a lot of synchronicity across asset markets. But I think we've seen in the last 3 years, there's been significant dispersion amongst assets on shorter term horizons across the global economy. As countries come out of whatever situation they're in, they have different policy settings. We think there's more scope for regional performance differences, whether it's across emerging markets or developed world. The US has been particularly range bound, but we've seen in the UK economy has been more resilient than people have expected. And that was kind of priced into markets, but now we're seeing a stronger consumer there. We're seeing some softening of the consumer in other parts of the world. So we think there's definitely scope to add value from being able to zone in on particular regions, look at the different performance dynamics, different policy settings, and express views around those.
How has that changed your views of where markets are attractive, and particularly how has it changed with where the U.S. rates? For the longest time, diversification wasn't really working for folks, and regardless of market conditions, the U.S. market was the world's best market. There's a lot of stuff going on right now. Are you finding that other parts of the world are better positioned moving forward?
So when we take views, we tend to express them in a variety of ways. So when we had negative duration views last year, we started in the US, we moved into Europe and the UK, we've expressed views in Japan. Where we are now on in terms of risk terms, overall, we're probably quite low in terms of risk. Where we're expressing those views, we're looking at the markets where we think the greatest asymmetry is. So we have short duration views in the UK, Japan, slightly more nuanced than the US. Why we like UK, because we think they have a persistent inflation problem. We think the central bank is still slow to react. And you can see this in their inflation numbers, in the core numbers and the headline inflation numbers. They haven't dropped nearly as much as the market expected. Similarly with Japan, we still think Japan to be disconnected to the rest of the world and broad-based inflation. We don't really buy into that. And there's nice asymmetry there. Yes, it's been a little bit painful this year, especially in March when rates were reversed, but that was completely unrelated to Japan. That was a global phenomenon. So we have a view on the US that we still think rates probably are biased to the upside, but because we're global in nature, we can really pick our spots on where we think the most attractive market pricing is at any particular point in time.
And when it comes to sectors and areas of the market, where are you finding the most attractive values and valuations?
In relation to what, the equity market?
Yes.
So we don't typically add too much value on a sector selection. We do take thematic views within equities. So things like defense spending have been a good contributor to the performance. We have some exposure to the energy sector, where we think that the underinvestment in the oil and energy sector, if you couple that with strong growth in the economy, we see the US economy remaining pretty resilient. We still think sectors like that are attractive. So we tend to invest a little bit more thematically than just picking out one sector versus another. One other comment I'd make on the sectors, which is kind of related to one of your earlier comments, is we're still short US regional financials. We think that, how this ultimately comes out of the system is unclear, but a lot of their business models are challenged. How they finance themselves, how they their net interest margin is under threat. So we're still short US financials. We're long European financials, which we think have actually been highly regulated, almost utilitized in their earnings potential. So we're short US regionals versus long European financials. So that's just an example of a thematic idea we have on.
And I'm curious about some of that in terms of your views on the banking market. You know, one of the distinct differences is that, like, we talk in this country about regional banks. Pretty much every other country in the world, we don't really talk about regional banks. You're not really looking at, like, oh, you know, they've got this in that valley and that other one in that commonwealth or that state or that province. So the banking sector here is much more developed. It's also much more fragmented. Is that also part of why you're perhaps more attracted to Europe and some of the others, because it's the small and the less consequential? And do you think we have to go through something here that makes our banking system maybe a little bit more like the others?
Yes. Well, there's 2,000 regional banks, I think, in the US or around that number. So there's a lot, very localized. And as we saw with Silicon Valley Bank, if you have concentrations, high concentrations of depositor bases, it makes the banks vulnerable. In Europe, you've seen kind of the opposite happen, where Credit Suisse and UBS came together. So you've almost got too big to fail at the other extreme. So, you know, I think we're not stock pickers and, you know, picking out individual financials, but on a broad base, we're looking at the US financials, regional financials, and thinking there's vulnerabilities there. The savings and loans crisis had a similar setup in the late 70s, where the Fed started hiking rates to put the lid on inflation. It took almost a decade for that to really run through the system and adjust their business models. And it took out about 30% of SNL institutions. So there might be something like this happening on a longer term basis within the US. We don't know exactly the time horizon or how it will play out. But if we look at the earnings engine for a lot of those regional banks, with rates going up and how they fund themselves and how they attract depositors, their earnings, you know, power, we say, is diminished.
Let's take it back big picture and away from any sector or industry. And we've talked a little bit about government issues and some of those other things. The war drags on in Ukraine. And obviously, Russia's really not investable until that ends. But in terms of what it's doing for the world, have we gotten to where we get to, you know, as long as it keeps going this way and it drags on, it's ugly. Nobody's happy about it, but it doesn't have much more impact than we've seen. Or is there a point where just the duration, the time, et cetera, is going to give it bigger impacts and make it that there's more spillover effects than the rest?
Well, there's a couple of big things going on, which the Ukraine-Russia conflict happened. But before that, there were inflationary pressures bubbling. This isn't just about Russia and Ukraine. And what we've seen in the energy market is actually there's been a lot of energy leakage from Russian oil and into the market. So energy's been fairly weak. But also there's been a big mega trend underway in Europe looking to become energy self-sufficient and try to reduce that reliance on Russia. So you've had huge investment in there in new technologies in Europe, which is a very interesting thematic that is investable as well. So that's kind of more of an investment idea. You know, that the political will for this dragging on will clearly depend a lot on who, you know, might be in the administration in the US coming up and the support there. But that doesn't seem to be wavering at the moment. So I can't say with certainty how this ends, and it's really a geopolitical issue. But we think this conflict will continue to last, and that has implications for the oil markets. But so far, those implications haven't been that high because Russian oil has still been able to find its way to market.
Yeah, for good or bad, depending on who you're talking about, there's a lot of fascinating stories going on about that. How long after conflict ends is it before Russia is investable again?
I don't know. It really depends on how that conflict ends and what that looks like. But clearly, both sides have supporters and key allies across the world. So until you really know how that conflict ends or in what state it's in, I don't think we can really comment on that.
Let's talk about a different global phenomenon in the limited time we have left that winds up moving people's emotions, if not necessarily moving markets, and that is cryptocurrency. you know, in all of this other sort of stuff, we still are arguing over whether or not crypto is an asset and is it real, et cetera. What's your take on crypto from a global perspective?
We got asked this question an awful lot 2 years ago, and we never invested in crypto, not because we didn't like it, but we just, our understanding and grasp of it wasn't as good as we felt we needed it to be to invest in. We felt there were other technologies around crypto which were interesting, which would benefit from the growth in crypto, which we participated in. And there were other assets which we felt had, they weren't crypto assets, but they had significant diversifying qualities, things like carbon emissions, which had very strong returns. And we clearly understood the drivers for those. So crypto, it's a digital version of gold in our mind. You know, it's clearly a key part of a lot of investors and portfolios. We haven't used it at all. We continue to monitor the situation and look at it, but we haven't made any investments in that.
And because I have to ask, if you look at it as digital gold, what have you been doing with gold and precious metals?
Yeah, we've been investing in that. Gold obviously moves, has a high correlation to real rates. So we look at it in that context. We also look at it from a perspective of central bank credibility. So if we think that markets view of central banks really being able to put the lid on inflation, gold also has a role in the portfolio. So gold, it's not a long-term strategic allocation in our portfolios. It's something we trade fairly tactically along with some of the other precious metals as well.
So here we are early June in the world of money life. The next time you and I are going to be talking, likely to be close to the end of the year. When and if we have that conversation, do you think we'll be looking at a situation where we're staring into 2024 pretty happy with the outlook, or we'll be staring into 2024 going, can we get through this trouble and get to where we're going to be happy again?
Well, I mean, the big thing for us is you've got this tussle in markets now between, is the recession coming or is the economy stronger and is inflation more persistent? So this is why the market's chopping around, in our opinion, is trying to answer these two scenarios. We think there's vulnerabilities really in either one of those scenarios to equities. Equities have had a strong start to the year. We discussed the leadership point earlier. Obviously, this has been helped by the kind of reduction in rate expectations. But in a world where we might enter a recession, that's probably not a good environment for equities. In an environment where inflation is stronger than people expect and activity is more resilient, that's probably not good for equities either, if the Fed has to do more or central banks around the world have to do more. In that inflationary environment, it's probably not so good for bonds either, but they might be okay. If it's in a recession, that's probably going to be reasonably good for bonds. So a few different playbooks, few different moving parts there, but we think there's vulnerabilities to equities for the second half of the year. This is something we're quite focused on. How you call the timing on it is always difficult, but we would say equities have probably got a little bit ahead of where they should be in a number of different scenarios.
And anybody who's been listening should know that, of course, when you're talking about vulnerabilities to you, that is also opportunities. That's part of what's been really interesting here. Paul, this has been a lot of fun. Thanks so much for joining me on the show.
Great chat. See you soon.
That's Paul Seaton. He's managing director at Fulcrum Asset Management North America, which runs the Fulcrum Diversified Absolute Return Fund, ticker FARIX. Want to learn more about the firm and its funds? Go to fulcrumassetfunds.com. And they're on Twitter at Fulcrum Asset. And we've got just a little bit to go on today's show. So stick around. We'll cross the finish line together right after this message.